برقة كما البيلسان، وحاورني بلغة الليلة كما نيسان. يا حبيبي يا حبيبي، رحل القمر وما زالت همساتنا
are listening to the beautiful music of the late Palestinian singer and songwriter Rim Banna, Seasons of Violet, Mousim al-Banafsaj.
Hello and welcome to Swana Region Radio, a weekly review of politics and culture, bringing you the voices of the voices from Kolkata to Casablanca here on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and 93.7 FM in Northern San Diego, as well as streaming worldwide on kpfk.org. My name is David Lloyd, here today with co-host Rana Sharif, members of the South Asia, West Asia, and Northern Africa, or SWANA Collective, that brings you your weekly half hour of SWANA Region Radio. Please note that our programs are now available for download anytime on Spotify. Just search for SWANA Region Radio on their website. You can also tune in at any time and listen to our archive shows under the Programs tab at kpfk.org. We begin our show with a review of the regional Arabic language press with collective member Hamoud Salih. Welcome to the show, Hamoud.
Hi, David. And I think Rana is there with you, too.
Rana is here, too.
Hi, Hamoud.
Hi, both.
So, Hamoud, this week the big news was perhaps the ongoing normalization effort between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, marked by two symbolic flights, one from the UAE to Israel and the other from Israel to the UAE. How is the region reacting to it, and what's your analysis of what's going on here with this so-called deal?
So the first observation is that there is not a single Arab news agency beside those that support the governments, especially in the social media, that hasn't attacked the UAE for being anti-Palestinian, giving a freebie to the Israelis. So the Emiratis got a lot of bad press on that front, and for good reason. This is not a simple political decision. It speaks volume to the current leadership, and the mass media, the social media in particular, didn't fail to mention how important Sheikh Zayed, the late Sheikh Zayed, the ruler of the UAE, who was very nationalistic, who was a very, very good friend of the Palestinians. And then the social media and also some of the press made the link to the current leadership and made literally fun of them, particularly the foreign minister who appeared on an Israeli television network, and in which basically ignored the Palestinian right and given history that favors the Israelis. Just as Al Jazeera inviting Israelis to speak, even though against the normalization, they, Al Jazeera, took the opportunity to attack the Emiratis as well as the Israelis. So it's a move that is not really unusual. We've seen this a lot with the Arab world. We don't know where it's heading. But the important thing is that we tend also to forget on many levels the countries today, we're looking at the United Arab Emirates as taking this normalization step. But in reality, the normalization step began a long time ago, perhaps with Camp David when Egypt recognized the Israelis, perhaps with Oslo when the Palestinians decided, or Madrid when the Arab world decided to recognize Israel and engage in a peace negotiation. So it's not new. And the serious objective advocates of the Palestinian causes talked about that. The rest of them, it's part of that sort of position of anyone, opposition that supports Palestinians. But in reality, we're still where we were before.
And Hamoud, there was some talk of long before this normalization deal went public of the UAE importing surveillance technology from Israel to survey its own citizens. Is there any reporting on that?
Oh, there is plenty of that on the social media. And you know, there is a, you know, it's funny when you look at how the leadership in the United Arab Emirates has evolved in recent years, particularly since 2014. And I believe that's when they cut the ties with the Palestinians, diplomatic ties with the Palestinians. This new leadership has changed tremendously, and it's totally opposite to what the old leadership was. And the absence of the role of the senior leadership, like in the old days in the UAE, Sheikh Zayed or Al Maktoum in Dubai, the other family, I forgot the name of the ruler in Sharjah, who's a very well-respected ruler. The role of that senior leadership has been sort of marginalized in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. But when you put it in a context, this is about the time when those leaders who were sort of studying in the 70s or 80s to be in the positions where they are. Most of the leadership, the elite leadership in UAE, has been formed or has gone to schools in the US or in Great Britain. And their understanding of the Palestinian cause is next to nil. In other words, they still see this as a problem that involves the Palestinians more than anything else, and their total ignorance of history. And then coupled to that, with that, when you look at who is advising the Emiratis, a lot of times these are senior officials from the United States. In the past, they used those advisors, but they would not pass the litmus test of the senior leadership, because those were, they have Palestinians' cause. I'm not saying that they were good guys, but they did not make the steps that this leadership made. So what the new leadership framed the security of the of Dubai in particular and the UAE in the context of their national interest and at the expense of the national causes, or the Palestinian cause, meaning that they came to the conclusion that the Israeli technology could support them. And that the Israelis are very clever in providing all the services for them to monitor, to do the checkpoint, all of that. So the Dubai government in particular find and they were doing this all the time, but they find this an opportunity for them to deal with the Israelis and get the technology that think best protect them, not thinking about the consequences that they might face in the public relation or how this cause a big impact on the Palestinian cause.
Hamoud, I just wanted to ask if you could follow up and elaborate a little bit about the idea that this deal, the supposed deal, ended annexation and from the position of the people.
It has nothing to do with annexation. What's interesting about is that you listen to whatever you listen. It was a media ploy. The entire thing was about the UAE and the Israelis decided to work together, the hell with the Palestinians. And the moment Netanyahu left the stage, he went and said, you know, the hell with the annexation, and never agreed with. And who really the Israelis. So and that's really the message that resonated very well in the Arab world. But again, it's that, you know, where we are at the stage where, you know, the Palestinians are victim or anything. And then we have this audacity to say, well, it's their fault. They're the one who reached to the Israelis. But we never ask the questions. Why did the Palestinians reach out to the Palestinians? What was our role? The first thing that the Gulf states did after the invasion of Saddam is to cut all funding to the Palestinians. Now, I'm not saying that the Palestinian National Authority was the ideal, whatever it is, but it was the Gulf states that drove the lack of funding that actually was behind some of the decisions that the Palestinian National Authority took. So I think I am going to leave it there, David, because I think we're running out of time. This is good. I'm playing the host now.
Well, thank you.
Myself and in the interview. Yeah.
Thank you. That was really helpful. And this is, of course, an issue we'll keep watching with you. Thank you so much for that roundup. And we'll talk again soon. A couple of weeks ago, as our regular listeners will recall, Rana and I covered Israel's recent so-called deal with the United Arab Emirates and its actually ongoing project of annexation by way of housing demolitions, settlements, and infrastructure expansion. Today, we continue our coverage of occupied Palestine, but with a wider lens. What has been the impact on historic Palestine of Israel's occupation and its much-vaunted development of the region on this delicate and fertile ecology of an ancient land? Does Israel's spurious and well-worn propaganda claim to have made the desert bloom actually mask its ongoing destruction of Palestine's environment, its uprooting of ancient olive trees, or its extensive plantations of pine forests to rapidly cover the ruins of the Palestinian villages it has destroyed? Is its massive water consumption exhausting the limited groundwater available, even as it denies Palestinians equitable access to that precious resource? What's the impact of its intensive agricultural projects in the Jordan Valley, the Nakab, and elsewhere on both the ecology and the flora and fauna being impacted by the process of desertification that affects the larger region from Syria to Yemen and East Africa?
Thank you, David and Hamoud, and welcome to our Swana Region Radio listeners. On behalf of the collective, I would also like to thank Melissa and Focus, MEIF, for providing us with their slot this afternoon in order to bring you a longer conversation today. On September 9, the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel will host a webinar on this issue of eco apartheid, to which we will link on our website and Facebook page. As they say in a statement, for Palestinians, environmental injustice is a key component of the ongoing Nakba. The list of Israel's ecological violations and crimes is long and gruesome. It includes the systematic destruction of Palestine's trees and fragile ecosystems, extensive toxic dumping, land grabbing, widespread flows of untreated sewage from the West Bank settlements, outsourcing of dirty industries across the Green Line, uncontrolled pollution of air and surface water, and ethnic cleansing of populations from their ancient sustainable habitats. All evidence suggests that Israel's maintenance of political apartheid is everywhere, reinforced by a pattern of practices best described as eco-apartheid. Today, we speak all about these topics with one of the webinar's panelists, Mazen Qumsiyev in Bethlehem. Welcome, Mazen.
Professor Mazen Qumsiyev, by training a zoologist and geneticist, teaches and researches at Bethlehem and Birzeit universities. He previously served on the faculties of the University of Tennessee, Duke University, and Yale University. He and his wife, Jessie Chang, returned to Palestine in 2008 and started a number of institutions and projects, such as a clinical genetics laboratory that serves cancer and other patients. They founded and run, as full-time volunteers, the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, which has become a kind of mecca for visitors to Palestine from around the world. Professor Qumsiyev has published over 140 scientific papers on topics ranging from cultural heritage to biodiversity to cancer. His many published books include Bats of Egypt, Mammals of the Holy Land, Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and the book Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, which is published electronically, and you can find it on his website at kumsia.org. He especially believes in youth empowerment towards social and environmental causes and serves on the boards of a number of Palestinian youth and service organizations. Professor Kumsia has himself been harassed and arrested for nonviolent actions, but has also received a number of prestigious awards for these same actions. Welcome to the show, Professor Kumsia, and congratulations on the awards.
Thank you very much, David, for having me on your show. Thank you, Rana.
It's a pleasure.
It's really an honor to be with you.
Well, Mazen, perhaps you could begin by telling us how and why you and your wife, Jessie, founded the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability.
Well, I mean, it's my interest in nature goes back to my childhood. And as the years passed by, of course, we all realize how endangered we are as a species, partly our own, or, you know, all of it is related to our own actions as humans. We are barreling down the road, sort of like lemmings, heading to a cliff, which we really need to avert this direction for our species, because we are destroying the planet also, in addition to eventually making this not a livable planet for ourselves. So it was really essential that we all get involved. And I have always been interested in activism and in social movements. And I always say that when I look at history, I see that the good things happen when people work together towards a cause. In the U.S., for example, how did we get civil rights? Women right to vote, 40-hour work week, ending the war in Vietnam, or ending up support for South Africa. All of these things happened when good people finally said, enough is enough and let's do something. So basically, this is the motivation that drives me.
Well, I visited the Institute maybe 5 years ago on a tour of universities in Palestine, and we met then. And I remember thinking that this initiative was really important by virtue both of what you were preserving and then what you were teaching both students and, I think, school students about what Palestinian ecology looks like, what the plants and the flora and fauna are like. One thing I remember distinctly, Mazen, was the little, not grove, but little plantation of za'atar that was near the pond in the center, and smelling the fresh za'atar, which I had, as a non-Palestinian, never smelt in its living form before. You tell us a little bit more about that work. You're both preserving, I think, species that are threatened and also teaching people about the ecology so that they can value it. Is my understanding right?
Yes, indeed. What we are hoping to do is, we live in a very difficult situation, of course, with colonial occupation, but Palestine is not a charity case. Palestine has always been very rich in agriculture. We're part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first developed agriculture. We have very rich habitats, rich biodiversity, and this continues to be, even despite all the obstacles, it's still, we did lose many species, but Palestine is also at the root of migrations for both humans and for other animals. For example, essentially most of the human species today came out of Africa through Palestine, and birds from Europe and Eurasia in general still migrate through Palestine to Africa on annual migrations of over 500 million birds pass through Palestine. So on the one hand, we have this, we're very lucky to be in this place geographically that's very special. The Great Rift Valley, the lowest point on Earth is the Dead Sea. All of this is beautiful, and it's really amazing that we live in this area. On the other hand, of course, in the past 100 years, as you know, we've been subjected to a relentless colonization and occupation that made most of our people refugees. 7.5 million Palestinians are refugees out of a total population of 13 million. And the rest of us, like my family, live in Pakistan and Bethlehem. So to go back to your point, is what the museum is about is a point of sanity in this insane world, if you want. We get together with young people. We create a small oasis of peace and tranquility in the middle of this mayhem. We have about 12 dunams of land. We have a community garden, a playground for children now. And it's a place where when people come, they feel safe. They feel they can build something and not just complain about all the destruction happening to their lives. So they feel they can do something. And this, to me, is essentially a beacon of hope in the middle of this, as I said, mayhem, destruction, cruel world that doesn't really respect native rights, and, of course, climate change and destruction environmentally around the world.
Well, Mazen, I appreciate that you don't want to dwell upon the destructive aspects, but I wonder if you would mind talking a little bit more about the impact of Israeli projects of occupation, but also the settlement of 48 Palestine, and the ways in which I remember you talking at one point about how the pine trees that had been planted in many places over the ruins of Palestinian villages had replaced native trees, and that this was perhaps one of the reasons why such fierce fires broke out a few years ago in Israel. But there are many things like that I think probably our listeners mostly don't have a sense of how the landscape has been changed by settlement and by the expansion of a European-style landscape, if you like, a European Mediterranean landscape into this region.
I mean, your listeners, of course, are familiar with European colonization of North America and how when the Europeans came, for example, they killed 2 million buffaloes. Right, now, they didn't kill buffaloes because they hated buffaloes or they wanted intentionally to destroy the environment. They killed buffaloes because they wanted to deprive the native people of their source of food, basically, and take over their land and transform the landscape to a Europeanized version that they came from. The same happened here with early colonization activities that started over 100 years ago, long actually before 1948. The idea was to transform the country and to take the natives out in some fashion or another and take their livelihood out. So, of course, they uprooted a lot of native trees, carob trees, fig trees, almonds, olives, etc. And they planted in their place these European pine trees. The idea is to make a monoculture, and pine trees grow fast, so they covered the tracks of the destruction of Palestinian villages. This started actually in the 1920s. Accelerated in 1948 with the massive ethnic cleansing of Palestinians that accompanied the foundation of the State of Israel as a modern state on the ruins of Palestine, basically. So 530 Palestinian villages and towns were depopulated. And this was a catastrophic environmental effect on the local landscape. And this is just one of many activities that the Zionist colonizers did in our country. Another example is the draining of the wetlands of the Hula area in the north, which ended up destroying 219 species in that area. And then another project I instituted when Israel was established right away, they started diverting the waters of the Jordan Valley from Lake Tiberias to the west. This drained up the Jordan Valley, and Jordan River basically stopped being a river and became basically a stream of water left over less than 1/20 of what it was before. And as a result, the Dead Sea, which is a small lake, the lowest point on Earth, salty lake, started shrinking and becoming more saltier, of course. And now Israel is building a canal that will take water from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, but actually not the water itself. They will desalinate it and then dump the sludge into Dead Sea. And this will destroy the habitats and the nature in Wadi Araba and also the coral reefs in the Red Sea. So, and I could go on for an hour speaking about these kinds of examples of colonial effects on the environment. But the bottom line is colonialists all want to take a country that had, I mean, I don't say total harmony between humans and nature, but relative harmony between the native people and their environment, and transform it to a European version of consumerist society, which has been devastating for the landscape of these countries, similar to what happened in other countries, not just here.
كبذور البنفسج التي لا تموت حبي لك لا يموت لا يموت كبذور البنفسج التي لا تموت لكنها تركض إلى حين تحين مواسم البنفسج
Thank you for joining us here on Swana Region Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, and 93.7 FM in Northern San Diego. Our guest is joining us from Beit Lahem. Mazen Qumsiyeh is the founder of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University.
Okay. The situation here with a system that was created to serve one community at the expense of another community, and two sets of laws, one for the native people and one for the Jewish colonizers from Europe and elsewhere, that benefits and privileges that community. This system of apartheid, just like in South Africa under apartheid, there's discrimination against native people. But there's also the system of eco-apartheid, as you rightly called it, Rana, is that we do have a system whereby, for example, Palestinian access to water versus Israeli access to water, which we, of course, this is our water. Israel takes more than 90-some percent of the water of the West Bank, for example, and the rest of it, some of it they even sell back to us, but they give us, they allow us very little of our own water. So we end up with using less than 1/8 of what Israeli Jews use for water. And they tend to water their lawns and have swimming pools. And even here in Bethlehem in the Jerusalem deserts, they have a water park, whereas Palestinians barely have enough water to drink. This has, again, an impact on our health, an impact on our environment. When Israel builds its industrial settlements next to Palestinian areas, actually some of my own master students did research on this, showing the effect of the industrial waste that Israel dumps on the local Palestinians, on their health. And we showed chromosome breaks and DNA damage. My background, as you pointed out, I was in medical, I was teaching in the medical schools at Duke and Yale universities. So we have some background in this. We did some research, and clearly there's an impact on human health, environmental health. So on every aspect, you can talk about environmental justice, about human rights, about all of these things are impacted by what's going on. It's very difficult sometimes to describe it to an audience who's not familiar with what is going on. I mean, literally every aspect of our lives and every aspect of the fauna and flora around us is impacted by the Israeli occupation of our lands.
So Israel has long claimed that they have made the desert bloom, and clearly that is just incorrect on so many different levels. How do you think about that claim, and how would you explain the ways in which Palestinians have traditionally cultivated the land and how they have or have not protected the environment, water, indigenous plants, etc.? So what is it that they are able to do or not do, given this context?
To start with, this claim is disproven even historically when they say there's a desert. We don't have a desert. We're part of the Fertile Crescent. We do have semi-arid regions that are in the south, in the Naqab or Negev, but most of the country is very fertile. And even in the Negev, in the Naqab, Palestinians used to cultivate what's called Baal agriculture, after the god Baal, because of our ancestors, the Canaanites, used to worship the god of rain, Baal. And so we had agriculture here that's very rich land, and producing enough food for everybody. Even in the Bible, if you remember, it says the land of milk and honey. And when the prophet sent a couple of his people to explore the land and see if they can conquer it, they came back, they claim with a stick carrying between them one cluster of grapes that took two men to carry. So the land has always been fertile. The land has always been very rich. Before 1948, for example, Palestine used to supply Europe with citrus fruits. As we say, most of European citrus used to come from Palestine, from Jaffa and those places, like Jaffa oranges and so on, the grapefruits, etc. So this country has always been very fertile. The notion that it's somehow a desert is simply factually not true. The second thing is, and this is the part where they kind of tricked the world into believing it, is they took some areas which I mentioned earlier, how they diverted the water of the Jordan Valley from Lake Tiberias. Jordan Valley's rich agricultural areas. The reason they diverted the water of the Jordan Valley to the west is to deprive Palestinians and Jordanians of the water they need for agriculture, which they used to have. That was irrigated agriculture in the Jordan Valley. In the hills and in the coastal areas, the agriculture before 1948, before the State of Israel, was dependent on rainfall. And we had plenty of rainfall. We're not short on water or rainfall to feed our agricultural crops, whether trees like olives and almonds and figs and so on, or whether things like wheat and barley, which do not require irrigation, they depend on rainwater. But when they diverted the water from the Jordan Valley to the western areas and the northern parts of the Negev, indeed they started growing other kinds of crops like cucumbers and tomatoes, which require water and irrigation. But the cost of producing those with this irrigated water that's transported basically over 200 miles to get there was more than the actual value of the crop, which is the ironic thing. So they were growing cucumbers and tomatoes much more costly than the other crops or than they needed. There's enough in the Jordan Valley they could have grown. So it was a propaganda ploy. It was not related to any economic benefit or any agricultural production or food security benefit. It was mostly to just claim to the world that they're growing more vegetables in an area they shouldn't be really growing tomatoes and cucumbers. They were growing before that. The Palestinians were growing wheat and barley and other things in those areas.
Well, Mazen, I envy your students. This is an incredible lesson on both history and ecology. But I wanted just to change the subject to a slightly different direction of your great work in Palestine. In addition to doing this crucial environmental work and creating, as you put it, an oasis of creativity and construction as opposed to a kind of constant mourning of destruction, you have yourself participated in and written about Palestinian popular resistance. And to go back to the question of history, many people, I think, are not aware that Palestinian nonviolent resistance long precedes the now well-known and very much vilified BDS movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel. But I wondered if you could tell us a little about your own participation in those popular movements and their longer history. I think it's important to know that history, given that Palestinians are always being asked to engage in nonviolent struggle and abandon violence, despite the fact that they've actually been doing so for about 100 years or more, right?
Yes. I mean, when you think about it, it's logical. When you have a colonialism, you have resistance. And what does resistance to colonialism means? Well, the first act of resistance by native people to colonialists is them being born. So when people ask me when you started to resist, I say when I was born, because literally, if you're born in a country that the colonialists don't want you to be born in, they would rather that you go and be born somewhere else so that they can have the land without a people that they aspire to, you can understand that existence here is resistance. Everything we do here is resistance. When I eat here, when I drink here, when I, get married or have children or anything I do here is a form of resistance. And this is important for people to realize, is that for native people, there are thousands and one ways of resistance, and most of them are nonviolent and do not use arms. I don't like to use the term, by the way, nonviolence, and we don't use it in the Arabic language. We refer to muqawama sha'biyya, which essentially means popular resistance. And actually, Mahatma Gandhi once was asked, why don't you use nonviolent resistance? He said, well, it's a negative terminology. We're talking about satyagraha and ahimsa and things like that, which are the positive actions that we do to remain in our land, to stay in our land, and basically to attempt to put a block in the direction of the colonizers usurping what's left of our land. That's essentially what it means. So that's why I say I wrote a book basically that describes some of these forms of resistance that we use. There's an American author by the name of Gene Sharp who once tried to enumerate the forms of what he called nonviolent resistance. And he said there are 198 forms of nonviolent resistance. I don't know why he couldn't come up with two more to make them an even 200.
But, he should have added being born.
He listed things like boycotts and civil disobedience and demonstrations and writing letters to editor and all of this. But actually, in my book, and I went through this, and I found that actually Palestinians used all these forms listed in Gene Sharp's book, plus many, many more, even long before Gene Sharp was even born. I'm talking about between 1880 and 1920s, in those 40 years. We've used all these forms of resistance to the colonial onslaught that came in our country. So for me personally, I mean, I think I do very little compared to what other people who sacrificed their lives and livelihood and everything for the struggle. Yes, I was arrested and detained a few times, but usually they release me fairly quickly, and so I haven't suffered as much as many of my friends and colleagues. I actually, since I came back from the United States in 2008, I lost 19 of my own personal friends who were killed by the Israelis. Young people, you know, amazing young people who are activists, who not one of them was engaged in armed resistance, by the way. But in any case, imagine losing 19 of your personal friends in a span of 11 years or so.
Yeah, it's hard for us to even begin to imagine that. But what is always really quite astounding and impressive to us here, who, although we don't live in a democracy anymore, we do at least have certain protections from the kind of violence, or at least some of us do have some protections from the kind of violence you're talking about. But the popular resistance continues clearly in Palestine. And in your blog and other writings, you've often been quite skeptical about the Palestinian Authority. And if I may add, indeed, development around Ramallah looks like it might be as destructive of the environment as Israel's own settlements. But quite apart from that, and the apparent political paralysis of the Palestinian Authority, what popular initiatives do you see emerging now that are filling what some perceive as a kind of political vacuum at the top?
Well, I am hopeful by nature, and I think when you look at the situation of Palestinians, we're 13 million people, and that's where I see the hope is. Every single one of these Palestinians, is again resisting in their own way, and I think there is hope for us getting through this very difficult period. Attempts at liquidating the Palestinian struggle and so on. Unfortunately, we face a very fierce enemy, of course, a very well-organized structure. And I'm not just talking about the Israel as a state, but Israel draws on a network of supporters who support Zionism. I'm not talking about Jews, because actually some of our best supporters happen to be Jewish. I'm talking about Jewish and Christian Zionists who are very passionate and very vehement in their support of Zionism and oppression of the native Palestinians. And also, of course, the Western governments, which are complicit and hypocritic, and also the Arab governments, Arab leaders, as we saw, in the United Arab Emirates betrayal, basically, the Palestinian cause. And, of course, some of our own leaders, Palestinian leaders, over the past 100 years have been, at best one can say inept or ineffective or not too smart, or at worst they can say that they are like Chief Buthelezi of South Africa under apartheid, who was kind of shrugging his shoulders like apartheid is here to stay and who am I to challenge apartheid. So we do have huge challenges. I don't want to underestimate them. But I also take, as a biologist, I take a bigger picture of the world. And when I look at colonialism, anti-colonialism struggles, which exist in just about every country on Earth at some point or another, what did they end up with? I think there is one of three possible scenarios. Either the Algerian scenarios, where the French left Algeria after over 150 years there. It was a sad thing. 1 million French had to pack their bags and leave. Some of them have never been in France in their lives, six, seven generations in Algeria. That's one scenario. And the second scenario is genocide of the native people. as happened in Australia and the U.S. Both scenario one and scenario two are very rare, by the way. Scenario three, which is the most common scenario, which is that the descendants of the colonized and the descendants of the colonizers live together in one country. There's no fourth scenario. That scenario three, by the way, is found in over 140 countries on Earth, including in the Western Hemisphere, by the places like Canada, Mexico, Central America, South America, all of it, Caribbean islands, Cuba, you know, Puerto Rico, all these places. They live together in one country for all its people. As a medical geneticist, I would say that's the most likely prognosis for this illness, if you want. And so the question is really about us moving in that direction. And of course, we do have all these obstacles I mentioned that we have to win over and transcend, and we will. Even the situation of Ramallah that you mentioned. Ramallah, in many ways, reminds me of, not that I visited it, but it reminds us of reading about Saigon at the time of the American occupation of Vietnam. Saigon used to be like very nice, lush, there were lots of hotels and businesses, etc., flourishing while the war is raging all around it.
It actually reminds me of a film titled Leila's Birthday when discussing Ramallah. And, you know, the kind of ostensible nature of occupation that we've come to understand as part of the militarization of Palestinian life are, you know, in terms of view, are absent. But the palpable existence of that militarization takes form in air, land, sea, food, the ecosystems. And so Ramallah, for myself, who was born and raised here in Los Angeles, my family's from Hebron, when I visit there, it's actually, there's an element of schizophrenia that almost emerges when looking at the kind of redevelopmentization, and now there's like a bustling, if you will, as it's been articulated in popular media, of a tech industry that is emerging in that area, and it does create a kind of false sense of consciousness around what militarization occupation, the impacts of that on different communities. And to think more about Palestinians, I think it would be important for us, if we're talking about eco-apartheid, and to discuss Gaza, for example, and levels of toxicity. So as a result of blockades, Israel's punitive targeting of infrastructure, you know, deplorable sewage system, lack of resources to build an infrastructure, Gaza in many ways is rotting. It's a zone of toxicity. So, Professor, perhaps you can speak a little bit more to the specific context of Gaza within, you know, this larger conversation around eco-apartheid.
Yeah, thank you, Rana, for this question about Gaza. Is really heartbreaking. I mean, it's 2 million people living in a very small piece of land, one of the densest areas of population on Earth, about 6,000 people per square kilometer. 97% of the water of Gaza is not drinkable. And you have, when you're talking 2 million people, actually 1 million of them are children under the age of 18. So situation is really bad in health, in environment, everything. And Gaza is besieged, basically intentionally starved as such, for a very, very good reason, by the way, which is that there's gas fields off of Gaza that Israel wants. That's why they besiege Gaza and try to punish it. There are 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. Two-thirds of them are refugees from 1948 who could literally look over across the fence and see their old lands that are now being used by the Israelis. And of course, you know, this is really, I mean, even the United Nations said it's unlivable now in 2020, it's unlivable. Which means what? Which means literally, and I hate to use this terminology, but it's stark, but it's actually genocide. there's genocide of people in Gaza. It's an attempt to kill a lot of people and get them off of the situation where Israel has to worry about them. They won't even let Gaza fishermen go out to sea now to fish more than miles. Many times they even stop them from going out in the 6 miles altogether. So the situation is really bad. I have friends in Gaza. We try to help them. I mean, one friend called me the other night in the middle of the night and told me, literally crying, that his children only have bread for the past 3 days and nothing else. And so they are really, really in bad shape. As I said, the water is not even drinkable, and people have to boil it and drink it, and really, really, health-wise, it's not very healthy. I can go on and on, but I get very depressed when I talk about Gaza. So,
well, thank you so much for that. And it is, I don't think it's a stretch to call what is happening as a genocide. And in an attempt to kind of give our listeners an opportunity to see how we can participate, change, and thinking about how to impact and challenge eco-apartheid, could you perhaps discuss the work of BDS and US ACFI more broadly and how folks can actually get involved in challenging eco-apartheid in Palestine?
I think, you know, this is very important. The best antidote to despair is action, basically. And that's a statement by another activist. I forget who it was now. But I think it's very important for us to act. And what can we act? Yes, we can do a lot to help each other. As I don't want to say people need to show solidarity to us, because it is the same struggle. We're not like showing solidarity with another group of people. It's a one species that we share this planet. And unless we act together, those greedy people who are really destroying our lives, I mean, we don't have much time to go into this connectivity of all these struggles. Why are we in Iraq, for example, as a U.S., you know, as U.S., I'm a U.S. citizen, but that's why I say, why are we? We are in Iraq because of Israel, because of support for Israel, because the Zionist lobby in Washington, AIPAC, and so forth, pushed for a war in Iraq that cost $3 trillion of our tax money, and we lost thousands of our own citizens who are sent to wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and soon. And in Syria, and now, and you know, they want to attack Iran. All of these things are connected, and if we don't realize these connections, we are going to always assume it's somebody else's problem. But it is our problem, and we need to act on it. And one way to act is to use BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, just like we did in South Africa with apartheid. We worked together to end that the regime of apartheid, and we have to end this regime of apartheid here. At our institute, we do a lot more in this regard, and we are happy to, you know, to host volunteers. We are happy to work with you long distance if people want to work. We have even a group called Palestine Action for the Planet, which is concerned not just about the environment in Palestine, but the environment around the world, and we work together. Even though we are impoverished and we are native people under assault, we still have a responsibility to our planet, and we work with any other human beings, native or non-native or others, to affect a change.
Well, Mazen, I greatly regret that's the time we have for our show today. It's been really wonderful to hear you. And we should probably have you on again and again.
Thank you.
But thank you, Mazen. Our guest today has been Professor Mazen Kumsia, founding director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University. If you have enjoyed our show, please consider making a donation to KPFK at kpfk.org. Don't forget to mention Swana Region Radio when you pledge. Your support, and only your support, keeps this program and this station on the air. We receive no corporate sponsorship, which is exactly what allows us to air this kind of programming. But that means we depend on you to survive. If you've enjoyed and benefited from our programming over the year, please pledge to KPFK's essential work on our website at kpfk.org. We thank you for your donations. That's all the time we have on our show today. The Swana Collective would like to thank our guest, Professor Mazin Kumsia. If you enjoyed listening to him today, you can hear him again on US ACBI's webinar on September the 9th. We've linked to it on our website and on Facebook. The webinar also features panelists Max Isle, a researcher at Wageningen University and the author of A People's Green Deal, forthcoming from Pluto Press, and Kalani Opua Young, board member of Kahea, the Hawaiian Environmental Alliance, and the Ho'opai Pono Peace Project, looking at ancestral knowledge resilience and contemporary grassroots organizing around climate change. I'll see you at the webinar. This and all our shows are available to download at kpfk.org under the Programs tab at the top of the webpage. You can also find them later on Spotify. Just search their site for Swana Region Radio and that will bring you to us. Thanks once again to our friends at Middle East in Focus for allowing us to use an extra half hour for this interview. You can tune in to them again next week, Sunday at 1 p.m., right before Swana Region Radio. And thanks, as always, to Ricky Herrera for production assistance and to Ahmed Ibrahim for editing our show for us. My name is David Lloyd for the South Asia, West Asia, and Northern Africa, or Swana Collective. And on behalf of my co-host, Rana Sharif, and all of our collective members, I would like to wish our listeners a great day. Yeah.